Session number 6125, reel 10.
Mr. Hale, tape 10.
We went down to the mines, and the mines were called Onorossi and Tiarossi because they used to branch off halfway down. There was a passage, and on the left was Tiarossi. They used to break away from us, and half of us used to go to Tiarossi, half to Onorossi. In Tiarossi, they were actually into the coal, but in our face, we were still in a grey rock. And when each new detail went down to take over in the face, the first thing you very often used to have to do was to get rid of the water. Trucks used to run down from the surface, used to run down on a narrow gauge rail, and we used to have to get rid of as much of the water as we could, which would sometimes be almost up to waist high at the face, so we would be working in water. It was timbered down part of the way, but I think the Japanese must have run out of wood, because for a long way back, I suppose almost 100 yards from our particular face, we had no timbering up, and as timber used to be come in, we used to have to stop our work on the face and go back and use up what timber there was to shore up the roof. We had many falls, quite a number of deaths. The hours were long. The Japanese used to come down with us, the Japanese foreman, who had a recognised steel helmet on, and he used to give us the detail of the work that that particular shift was to do during their shift. They would measure from a point in the ceiling to the face and say, right, you've got to take it back another metre or 2 metres. And we learned that if we had a good going, that it didn't do to finish too early. Otherwise, they would simply add us a bit more on. And so we used to try and work to what we thought was perhaps a 12-hour shift, and then let the Japanese know by the person who was taking the rock up that we'd finished their stint, and in the fullness of time they'd come down, put on their measure again, and either okay it or else detail more to be done. We had pneumatic drills, small drills, very similar to the type of affair that you see in the streets around here, only lighter. These had a kind of a pick in the end of it, or what looks very much like a large chisel affixed to the end, and you'd dig at the face with these. And also they had a drill which was just over a metre and a half I think it was, or a metre and a quarter in length. It had a hole right up the centre, and you attach these to your pneumatic drill, and these would revolve, and you'd use these to drill to put dynamite in. What would happen is one man would work the machine, and his mate would kneel down in front of him with the drill resting on his shoulder. And as the drill went into the rock, it had a hole right up through the centre of the drill, and the man working the machine would trip the machine, and that would force air down through the hole and blow the dust back. So the man who was kneeling, taking the weight of the length of the drill on his shoulder, would get covered in dust, as would actually the man who was working the machine. So bits of rag were tied around our face, and we used to get absolutely covered in grey dust. Our mates next door, of course, got the coal, but it was most unpleasant drilling. And we used to have to drill in a metre and let the Japanese know when we'd drilled the required number of holes, and then we'd advise them that the holes were drilled. They would come down with dynamite and would wire up, and then we'd go back to the join where we broke away into the other mine, and then the dynamite would be detonated by the Japanese or by one of our men under direction of the Japanese. It was a plunger. And fortunately, we had an American who was a coal miner on our shift by trade. He was working on the oil fields and coal mines in America. And we had a Welshman who was actually a coal miner before he joined the British Army as a conscript or a Bevan boy. Anyway, he had worked down the mines. And after had done an explosion of dynamite, these two used to go down by themselves to the face and test the roof before the remainder of us would be called down to start clearing the face. And I think that those two, they probably saved a good many lives by their knowledge. And at the end of our stint, we used to be taken up to the top, handed over to the police, and they used to march us back to the camp and dismiss us. There were two large tubs, supposedly to be prepared by the remaining personnel who probably were sick or officers who didn't work down the mines. These were supposed to be prepared so that hot water was available when we came back from the mines to have a wash down. It's the Japanese way of washing, as far as we were concerned, were two large tubs. One of them you got in and you soaked yourself down, if you had any soap. And then you moved over to the next tub and you bailed water all over you to wash the soap off. Rather a good idea, in a way, if it worked. But what used to happen, the officers used to prepare these baths, and when it was hot, they used to use them. So consequently, it's often found that when we went to use the baths, although we were the ones who did the work, when we came to use them, the officers had used them, and either they were cold or else had been well and truly used. Not that that made much difference, because time you put 50 or 60 people who'd been working through a coal mine through these tubs, it was just stirring up a lot of mud anyhow. And of course, some of the personnel was really too tired to bother to go into the hot water. Incidentally, when we came out of our mines and were walking through the top of the mines, some of the men who were in very, very poor straits worked on the top, close to the pit head bars where the Japanese miners had their baths. And we could see them. They were like big, what we would think of as swimming pools in the UK here. And they were all hot. And the Japanese miners used to be in them. You could see all the Japanese girls really scrubbing them in the mines. The toilets were communal toilets, and we found it rather amusing that to see that if the Japanese men and women were queued up to go to the toilets, if a man happened to be behind a girl, she would relinquish her place in the queue, and poor girl used to have to wait till the Japanese male went through in front of her. I've even noticed her hand over any toilet paper to the man if he didn't seem to have any.
Did the officers work at all down
there? The Japanese asked the officers if they would work down the coal mines with the men. And to a man, with one exception, they refused to work down the coal mines with the men. Not one of them would work down, except Captain Lynch. And when I left, he had to put up his crown. He became Major Lynch of the Royal Army Medical Corps. He was the only officer who would come down the mines and stay with the men.
Did that cause a resentment?
It caused a lot of misery. But there again, they weren't the officers as we like to think of officers. They were ranker officers. And it may seem a harsh thing to say, but I found very few ranker officers that came up to the standard of what we would call the old school Thai officers. Even in the fighting of Hong Kong, the better officers were the professional officers. But they didn't. They were British officers, and they wouldn't come down the coal mines with the men, although there were American personnel with us. There were no American officers in this camp with us in Japan.
So their job consisted of, say, selecting the work party each day?
Selecting the work party each day with the Royal Army Medical Corps. When he was allowed to supersede any orders given by a Japanese medical private. Because as far as the Japanese are concerned, if you're wounded, if you're medically unfit, you're useless. I mean, and if you, for any reason, your medical officer said you were running a temperature 103, you can't go down the mines, well, no rice would be provided for you that day. That was on the instructions of the Japanese. And our payment by the Japanese for working down the coal mines was cigarettes. Of course, you weren't allowed to smoke down the coal mines, so that follows, of course. And your payment was 10 cigarettes for 10 days' work. If you weren't allowed to work by the medical officer, if you couldn't really crawl to the mines, if you only worked 9 days instead of 10, you didn't get your 9 days' cigarettes. And you got no food for any day that you were off sick. Of course, food was provided by your mates who would go short to ensure that at least you did have any. We understand that there were Red Cross medical supplies in that camp. We had quite a number of cases of very severe malnutrition. One very, very bad case of asthma, and the doctor begged them Japanese to allow him to get, I think, the drug he really wanted was adrenaline to stimulate the heart in this case. And the Japanese wouldn't give permission for any Red Cross stores. The hours were very, very long. The food was very poor. And the accident rate was very high throughout the time of our sojourn in the Japanese camp. And our outlook for our expectation of life was very, very slight. Because when they marched us back from the mines, we could see all the elderly, all the women, all the youngsters were all being trained in the martial arts of throwing hand grenades, bayonet practice with wooden rifles. But they were obviously going to be geared, every man, woman and child, to do their best to forestall or push back any likely invasion of the Allied powers. And they told us through the interpreter that should the British and American land in Japan, we would be executed. And if we really gave up hope and really believed it, well, as did happen in so many cases, the men, as I said before, just wrapped up and died. And it was only faith and will that something would turn up, as of course it did, that would save our lives. Well, the days and nights went on. Discipline by the Japanese was very, very fierce. We had our old friend from Shamshipo days came back to us in the nature of lice. That came back when we did try and sleep, although exhausted as we were very much troubled with lice and fleas, which got into this kind of rush mat that we had. It was very, very cold. We were north of Port Arthur, which is a port which is frozen over, as you know, throughout the winter months. 12 foot of snow is not uncommon. But marching back through the villages, inside of us was a railway line. We could see the trains going over. Going over the lines, very heavily camouflaged. And one day, as it turned out to be, it was early month of August, coming back through the mines, you weren't allowed to talk. You could get by whispering because the Japanese police were marching us back, civilian police. They had long staves on us, and anybody that talked, and in particular whistled. Whistling, the Japanese won't tolerate under any circumstances. We learned afterwards that they only whistled to dogs, and if you whistled, they would think you were insulting them. And you never whistled down a coal mine. We learned that a whistle, the vibration, as a vibration will shatter a glass of a certain high-pitched note, a whistle can bring down a roof in a coal mine, which therefore became a safety measure for all of us concerned. But a friend of mine, my best man again, as it turned out to be, whistled coming back from the mine one day. God knows where he had to whistle back, but he did. And the Japanese called him and gave him a frightful beating on the way back just before the war finished. And shortly after that beating that he had, coming back from the mines one day, we saw a train go by and it wasn't camouflaged. And we noticed it, and it came by in a whisper. And a Japanese said to one of the people, who was caught whispering, "Central worry." And interpreted, that means war finished. And that came back through the lines of marching men as quick as anything. "Central worry, central worry." And spotting the train gave us some idea that that may be so. And, of course, the spirits lifted, and we came back, and they dismissed us very quickly. They didn't bother even to recount us. When we got back to our huts, we never had to go through the formal Japanese dismissal, because all our commands were in Japanese, and we had to speak in Japanese the commands. But they even let us off parade without the formal dismissal. So we got back into the hunts. And one of the persons who had been left behind was a sergeant major, sergeant major of the Middlesex Regiment, Sergeant Major Overy. He was supposed to have been suffering from a dicky heart, so he got off the coal mining with the connivance. That was flash of lightning, with the connivance of the RAMC officer, Major Lynch, and he was a very ruthless disciplinarian himself. I don't know if I mentioned before, but he kept discipline by a very quick blow. He's a very rugged man, and he would beat up anybody that that failed to comply with his orders. And he'd even beat up the merchant seamen. And, of course, when one thinks about it, retaliation, to retaliate to the sergeant major, even one dared, realising what a rugged man he was, he'd got the whip hand because he was simply in his power to report you to the Japanese, and they would punish you far fiercer for striking one of your NCOs possibly than they would for their own people. So he had the whip hand of keeping discipline with his fists. Anyway, he was a pretty rugged individual, and he did fix up quite a number of men, of his own people. And he believed that the war had finished because he had seen certain signs going on around the camp whilst we were down the mines. And later on that night, when it came to the Japanese came into that, the interpreter and the Japanese sergeant and private came in with fixed bayonets, as they did that same night, to take the count. Instead of the sergeant major, who was the senior non-commissioned officer in the hut and normally would bow and give the count, instead of him doing it that night, he told the interpreter and the others with him, in no uncertain terms, in Anglo-Saxon language, to get out. Of course, they were all four-letter words. But strangely enough, they went. But they left a sentry on that night to parade all the way round. And they ganged up on this sentry and they took the bayonet away from him and kicked him out of the hut. And there was still no formal declaration of anything by the Japanese camp commandant to say that the war had finished. But the following morning, everyone was getting excited, thinking that something happened. We had orders to parade, and the British and the Americans officers, people who hadn't seen much, who never worked down a coal mine, cookhouse people, men who'd run the cookhouse, all suddenly appeared on this parade, and the Japanese commandant and a higher-ranking officer, I think it was a colonel, a Japanese colonel, stood on a platform and started to make a speech that through unfair tactics by the Americans, who had fought the war unfairly and dropped a bomb, the war was finished, and now we would all be good friends and we would all shake hands, and the war was over. But he stressed that the Americans had fought the war unfairly. So, But, and he said that we would be retained in camp under Japanese guard for our own protection, because they didn't know what the Japanese civilians would do to the British and American prisoners of war who were in their near vicinity.
You received a little present as well, didn't you?
Yes. A present came a week later. It consisted of a card, a Japanese card, and a fan. A paper fan was given to us as a presento, the Japanese called it, for the cooperation that we'd given to the Japanese war effort by working down the mines. I've still got mine at home, and it has been suggested that, and I've got my rice bowl at home and my miner's hat, and it has been suggested that I hand them over to the War Museum. They're welcome to them if they would like them. I'd personally like to see them come if they would say that it would be of use to them, because they're only shoved in a case out in my garage, actually. But I've got one or two. I've even got pieces of rock, and I've still got I don't think I've got the fan, but I've got the card. And if things have gone rough with me at home in latter years, I've often looked at this card and thought how things were worse. Well, of course, following or at the meeting when they told us the war was finished, our officers immediately took charge. And the British flag, which was had been concealed about the body of one of the men in the camp, was run up the flagpole, and an American flag appeared. That was put up the flagpole. We sang God Save the Queen and the American anthem, which even the Americans didn't know. I think we ended up with John Brown's Body Lies a Moulding in the Grave. I think that ended up with the American anthem. However, we were all excited. We weren't too much worried about that, though. Quite a number of men, myself included, broke down and cried because we never thought we'd ever see the British flag and again flying, or the American flag. And it was a very, very traumatic and really wonderful experience. An experience, thank God, has been given to few, I suppose, throughout history. But it was really wonderful. And then, of course, that night, we're all waiting for things to happen. The commandant was sent for and told that he was to provide us with the better meals, and meat was to be brought in and fish was to be brought in, and that was promised it would be so. And then during the night, a terrific lot of shouting was heard on the outside, and lo and behold, there was two British commandos or parachutists arrived, an American. Three arrived into our hut. I think all told about a dozen reached us. And they told us that first thing we were asked, the British asked them for a player's cigarette, because we'd been smoking the Japanese cigarettes. Player cigarettes, they brought some of those with us, and they said they'd come to list the numbers in the prisoner of war camp and also take details of any who were too ill to travel and to get details of urgent medical requirements and to arrange signals that would be posted in order that food and clothing drops could be made to us. They didn't stay with us more than hours, and they were away again, and they told us not to worry, things would be moving to provide us with all necessaries. And they also told us that there was a Chinese prisoner of war camp within short distance from us, and it fell to a lot of our camp to look after their welfare and supply them with food. Apparently they had been prisoners of war for somewhat more than 10 years. They were taken on the original Sino-Japanese conflict. We did stake out certain items of clothing and stones to form a POW signal. And that very quickly, only a matter of well, it may conceivably have been the next day or the day after next, a fighter plane came over and identified where we were. He waggled his wings, and within hours, bombers came over and dropped oil drums and clothing bundles. Unfortunately, these drums, which turned out to be loaded with cocoa and milk powder and all sorts of nutritious foods, were big oil drums welded together, and they broke loose from their parachutes as they came out of the plane. And some men, unfortunately, were killed in the drops of what should have been food and items of clothing to save their lives. One fell down on the what was the cookhouse, and it killed all the personnel. All of them were killed, and they, unfortunately, were the civilian women and children were working in the cookhouse at that time. Killed all those. And we had air raid shelters dug, and what happened when the bombers used to come over with the food and clothing and carton upon carton of cigarettes and sweets, we used to have to go to the dugouts to get out of the way of the falling stuff. Eventually, of course, we managed to get a radio come down intact, and we were able to tell them what was happening. And of course, they eased off, and they sent over a Japanese, American fighting planes, Grumman's, I think they were called, a little blue fighting plane off the carriers. And one of the things we asked for was bread, and they said, okay, that would be sent to us. And they dropped hot bread onto us. That came down quite nicely in parachutes. And then these fighters came in, and they had wooden torpedoes attached to their undercarriage. And unfortunately, there again, we suffered deaths and injury, because they'd release these wooden torpedoes, and they'd strike the ground, and they would burst. And they were containing tin stuff and tin foods, and that tins of milk and tins of meat were flying around. And there again, they were striking the ground with such force that the things were flying in all direction, and personnel were getting killed and injured again, which was unfair. I expect two or three dozen people were killed through food drops of one sort and another. They were brought down power cables. We had power cables that were sparking and flying all around us. It was really horrifying that men were really breaking down with sorrow to see that you come through so much and that you're losing your mates through what should have been kindness to get out. I think to go on a bit further, details came through as to what was to be done to us. We learned that as soon as...